I was 20 years old, and I was coming home from, I'll start a little earlier. The first time I traveled out of the U.S., I was in my third year of university, and I went to the U.K. to study. I was in London for kind of a semester abroad, and I was just really blown away, because I'd grown up in New York, where everybody was sort of Jewish and very small world, you know, kind of religious, and I just never felt, even from the age of I was like 12 years old, I was like, I don't think this is for me. Okay. So the first time when I went to London, you know, I was looking for ways to get out, but I didn't really have money, you know. So I was young. So went to London, went to school. On Christmas break, went to Morocco. It kept getting better. I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Went to France. It was pretty good. So I really, you know, went to around England. I really liked what I saw, you know. And there was a lot of, you know, LSD. There was a time a lot of LSD and pot and everything. And that made it better. You know? So, you know, wherever I went, it was pretty beautiful. And then I came back to the States. I was going to university in Washington, D.C. At the time, it was a time of the Vietnam War. And it was a time when we were involved in protests against the war. There was always big protests in D.C. I was thinking, how can I get my parents to send me away again? So I knew that they were religious, and I knew they would send me to Israel. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go there. Fine. And I knew I could go and work on a kibbutz. That seemed pretty cool, kind of communal type living. Mm-hmm. I was interested in that. And so I went, and it was good. I enjoyed it, you know. I picked pears. I was there for 2 months, get up in the morning. Kind of beautiful place. And it was interesting, the name of the kibbutz was Megiddo. Megiddo comes from the word R. Megiddo, which means like Armageddon. In English, it means Armageddon. And Armageddon is the place where you have the kind of conflict between good and evil, where good conquers evil sort of thing. So we would sit up, and there was a hill there. Basically, it was this hill where this was supposed to happen, this sort of kind of war. We'd get stoned, go up to the hill. I guess we'd smoke on top of the hill. Get stoned, and, you know, it's kind of like, oh, it's really cool. And then we'd have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'd go out and stand on these ladders and pick pears. I was from New York. I wasn't, what did I know about pears, picking pears, right? But I liked it. So then after that, at the end of the summer, I had to go back home. And so I went, I had a very old uncle and aunt who lived in Tel Aviv. Stayed with them, and I really, that summer too, I traveled. I went to Greece. I went to Rhodes. I went to some other islands. I was just like blown away. Wow, this is great. I love this traveling, you know? It was so beautiful. So then I got on the, I remember that morning, they were supposed to wake me, but I got up really late, and I was basically like running to get me a taxi to get me. I was like the last one on the plane. So I get seated on the plane, and I'm in the middle seat, and it's a flight to, gonna stop in Frankfurt, and then go on to New York.
And you were wearing?
I was, oh. What was I wearing? You thought I was wearing a djellaba? A black dress?
No, got you into trouble. What were you wearing?
Was I wearing shorts? What was I wearing?
Weren't you wearing a military?
No, that was in my bag. No. I was just wearing, you know, I was wearing my purple jeans. I used to wear them a lot then. And probably a yellow t-shirt. And so, and I was reading Kurt Vonnegut. You know who Kurt Vonnegut is?
Yeah.
The author. I had a host. I had a few of his books. I was going to sit and read. So I sat in the seat. It was an Indian man. The flight, it was a round-the-world flight. It had come from Bombay. The man next to me didn't speak any English. Next guy on the other side was also an Italian guy he was a spice dealer going to Bombay. Went to Bombay, was coming back to New York. So the flight takes off from Tel Aviv, and about maybe I'm sort of seated in the back of the plane, maybe like an hour out of Tel Aviv, or maybe 2 hours out of Tel Aviv. We hear this like commotion going on in the front of the plane, and I say to the guy next to me, like, what's going on? And he says, well, I can't, you know, he could kind of see down the aisle. And he said, I don't know, there's people running down the aisle. I don't know what's going on. So what had happened was that there were three hijackers on the plane. And that was before there was any incidents of international terrorism. So this was an American carrier that's no longer around. TWA was a big one in those days. And they got on the microphone, and they said, within a few minutes, they got on and they said, do not be afraid. This is we're taking you to a friendly country. This is the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine. So PFLP. So we feel the plane turning around the air. So, and then we flew back all the way to past Israel. We flew for, you know, we had flown all that time. Now we turn around and we fly more. We fly back. We didn't know where we were going. They didn't tell us. And we couldn't get out of our seats. So, and the stewardess is like, everything was buttoned down. Couldn't do anything. So then, you know, there's children on the plane. It's the end of the summer. Lots of people on the plane were religious Jews in a panic because they knew that this was not good for Jewish people. Because, like, especially if you look like Orthodox, or you had, some people had dual passports with Israel, and, you know, some of these people had parents who were in the Holocaust. I mean, this was, like, very real, right? And so the plane turned around. A couple hours later, we land in Jordan. And the plane comes down on a small runway. It's nighttime by that time. It was dark anyway. And there was this ring of lights around the short runway, because we could see the runway. And it was tanks all around. And as soon as we landed on a very short runway, because, you know, they come to like an abrupt halt like that. Mm-hmm. And then they open the door, and all these like commandos come on the plane with guns. And they're young men, women, and they're like marching through looking at us. Then we, you know, it's like, okay, what is this? What's going on? So I know it's hard to believe, but I really wasn't too, even though they had these guns and all this, I had no context for understanding this. And the reason that I'm saying this to you, like, it's hard to believe, is because when I wrote the story and read it when I took that class last year, the people were like, that's not possible that you weren't afraid. I said, really, I wasn't afraid. I never heard of this before. I mean, yeah, there were people with guns, but I had heard a few times they had taken planes, like, people had taken planes from the U.S. to Cuba, and then they took the people off the plane, they just wanted the airplane, and then they sent them back. So I thought, okay, this is going to be a delay. I was like, really, literally look at my watch. Oh God, how many hours are we going to be late to New York? My parents are going to be waiting at the airport. And like, some, you tell that to someone today, and they're like, people are walking around with guns, and you're not scared? Not yet. I wasn't scared. So then, within the few hours, two other planes joined us, and they had three planes.
The big ones also.
The big ones. Yeah. An El Al plane full of passengers and a Swiss Air all lined up. Yeah. We just sat on the plane. We sat on the plane for 1 week. For 7 days, we were on the airplane.
Just on a plane? They didn't let you out?
They didn't let us out of the plane. And there was no electricity. We were in the desert. It was the end of the summer. They just would bring on water, sardines, and some a little bit of pizza bread, and they would feed us. Now, the second day after we were there, they took the women, all the women and children, young children, women who had young children, they took them off the plane. But they left me and four other women, because we were all kind of late teens, you know, early 20s. And they had a reason. The first day, actually, they took us off the plane, and how they had to take us off the plane was they had a like a pickup truck. They put a ladder, like this kind of ladder, on the pickup truck. And then we had to get down from the plane. They pulled all the luggage out of the hall, and you had to identify your bag. And they looked at it, and I remember, I mean, they really went through it, and that's where you're talking about getting in trouble. I had pictures of myself with a friend who had, everyone in Israel has to go into the army at 18. So I had pictures of my friends in army uniforms and in shirts. I had a shirt. A friend had given me an army, you know, just like a khaki shirt. And they said, ah, you're in the Israeli army. Because at that time, people did go. You know, some people joined the Israeli army. You're in the army. Well, no, I'm not in the army. You're in the army. Then I remember they took out, I had a box of Tampax. And they couldn't figure out. I mean, they literally went through everything. You know what Tampax are? What you use when a woman has her period. Like this, and I'm like, oh, God. And they didn't know what it was. And then, you know, so there were just, there were a few, there were, every night they would take people, you know, sort of off the plane. It was, there was no electricity, so there's no way, you couldn't like flush the toilets or anything like that. So you can imagine that, and the smell, and the lack of water, and the heat. And we really sat there for 7 days on the plane. Only we could get off the plane like once a day. And then just kind of walk around the plane and get back on the plane. And then the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, Green Red Crescent, you know, from Jordan would come and they would give us a little bit of food. They'd bring us a little bit of food. We had no idea that anybody knew anything because at that time, you know, it was before... before the internet and before anything, you know, and there was no media there or anything like that. So we had no idea really what they wanted or anything. So we just saw that from all the planes, they, like, slowly, like at night, when it was dark, they would come on with flashlights and they would take some of the men off the plane. We had no idea where, I didn't know what was going on in the other planes. But we didn't have communication with those people. But they would come, you know, they would take people. We didn't know where they took them. You know, first they took sort of the younger men, younger meaning like, you know, in their 20s. They took the older men. Then finally, there were just very few people left on the plane after the 1 week. And among us were five women. We were really scared because, you know, five young women on the plane with all these men around, you know, with guns. At one point, they took me into the cockpit and they interrogated me. And they said, you know, you are part of the Israeli army. I said, no, I'm not. And that was the time I really did get scared. And then they held a gun to my head and they said, we're going to kill you if you don't tell us the truth. I said, that's the truth. I'm not part of the Israeli army. But they decided to keep me. So finally, on the seventh day, they took us all off the plane. The people who were left, there were about, I don't know how many people, there were three busloads of people left, with small buses, like minibuses. They put us on the buses, and they took us to the edge, like edge of the runway. This was a runway that was from World War II. It was called Dawson's Field. It's outside of Amman, Jordan. So it was probably, we were about as far as the edge of this house here, or maybe as far as the stick. I don't even think as far as the stick. They parked the cars, they planted dynamite under the planes, and they blew them up in front of us. So we had just been on the plane for 1 week, right? And that was just like, oh my God. And it was just like these three, you know, they had, I didn't tell you this, but they had written like on the sides of the plane, you know, down with imperialist, you know, down with imperialism, you know, this sort of thing. And then there was just these black plumes of smoke. You can imagine when you blow up a plane, how big and wide and black that is and how far it reaches in the sky and the sounds that it makes as it blows up. Right. And there was three of them. And they were cheering. They were so excited. We were on the bus. We were like, oh. You know, this was like scary stuff. Then after the, you know, the plumes of black, they'd put off all the dynamite that planes were blown up, and they start going down some road. And at some point, not very far along, there were people along the way sort of kind of cheering. They were so excited that they had these hostages and they had done this amazing act. These were all Palestinian refugees. And they, Subaz's went one way towards Amman, towards the airport, towards freedom. And we went another way. They took us to a small place, like a small, like, room. Kind of, I don't know, meeting room or something like that. And then they said, there was not very many people. There was probably, there were people from the three planes who I didn't know, and there was the five women from my plane. And then they said, okay, now you are our hostages. And unless, you know, we want, we're going to, you know, make some demands from your country, you're going to be our hostages. And then when I heard that, I was like really scared. Then I started to cry. That was the first time I cried. Then after a while, we got back on the plane. They took us to a small house outside of Amman, in a refugee camp outside of Amman. And there we met up with some of the men who were also with us previously. And so in total, there were 30 of us. 5 women, 25 men. And men were of different ages. So a few of them were college age, like me. Most of them were older. And so then we were there for, well, first, the first few days was good because we couldn't leave the house. We had a guard, several guards. But we didn't know what they wanted. We had no idea. One of the women with us was Egyptian, so she spoke Arabic. And every day the women, Palestinian guerrilla women, would come and we would sit and talk to them. And then we had this woman, Sarah, who spoke Arabic, so she could translate for us. So that was the first time I really heard their story from their voice. And it was really interesting, you know, to hear about their lives and, you know, how they were living and what they had gone through. And
the kidnappers.
They weren't the guerrillas who kidnapped the plane, but they were the women guerrillas who worked for the, you know, they were part of the PFLP. Mm-hmm. So they were part of the movement. So they would, you know, just come and see us. So, and we were happy because we had running water, we had a bathroom of sorts, we had more food. But we all slept, the women slept in one room. It was like a two-room little house, and the men slept in another room. And after about 1 week there, we had 1 week in that house. And then after a week, a war broke out between the PFLP and the Jordanian army. And it was largely about this international incident. They didn't want them to hold us. So then they started dropping bombs on the area. They tried to stop the kind of Palestinian sort of insurgency. But it became very dangerous. They didn't know where we were being held. It was very dangerous for us because there were bombs dropping daily. And so then we all moved into one room, and every time we could hear a bomb, you know, like whistling in, we would sort of run over to a corner. And then that went on for like 2 weeks of this terrifying thing, like, where can we hide, right? And the places, like, our guard would go to get us water, he wouldn't come back, he'd been killed. Houses being blown up. We could hear it, but we were somehow miraculously saved. You can ask, well, how did you get through that, you know? Well, I think one way was when it got really bad, we would joke about what our funeral procession would be like and how we would come home in these boxes, you know, and they'd have American flags on it, and we'd have this, like, we'd just go through all the details of the big procession in D.C. based on these hostages who were coming home dead. And that, you know, there were people who had good sense of humor, and it was very funny, you know, because there's one way, humor is a great way to get through better than panic or, you know, hopelessness. There were some very orthodox, like, rabbis there who didn't really mix, you know. And you would think that those people would have the most kind of contact with God at this moment, right? And I think I kind of
face-to-face with my own mortality, of course, and kind of felt like maybe there's nothing really there. You know, like there's nobody to believe in. Why would this happen? What's the cause of this, right? And what do you do with it? You know, like, I did feel hopeless, but, kind of some of the joking, I think, helped. You know, there were moments of joking, but I think most of the time we felt very, very scared and stressed. So, and as soon as this war broke out, the women stopped coming to visit, and, you know, it was just dangerous to be outside. So one day, after, you know, like 27, 28 days, they come running in. Just somebody comes running in and says, "You're free. Grab anything white that you have, because we're going to take you to a place where the Red Cross will pick you up. Red Crescent will pick you up." So then, we didn't have anything with us, but everything had been blown up on the plane. Certainly didn't have anything white. Didn't have any flag or anything, you know, anything to pick up. But you know what, we took a, you know, like a cover that was on the, you know, thing, a towel, whatever we might have. And we started walking in this. They just literally opened the door and said, "Go." Because the bombing was so intense and it was so, like, if they lost us and the house was blown up, then they would have done it all for nothing. And then they would have all this very black sort of taint on their movement, and it would be even a bigger international incident. Now, I have to tell you, up until this point, didn't know anything, and anybody knew anything about this. We had no, of course, I knew my parents had gone to the airport. They didn't find me. We knew they probably informed the people, you know, families, that, you know, there's been a hijacking. But besides that, we didn't know what the news was or what, you know, really what their demands were. They wanted their, we learned, you know, that they wanted their people freed, you know, people who were being held in Israel. And they wanted land, their own land back. Mm-hmm. Things that wouldn't happen and things that our government couldn't do for them. So it was very, you know, kind of impractical. But it was a real show of power on their part. So here we were walking in this place, walking in this village, and a few steps out of the house, two women come running up to us with babies. And because we were with Sarah, who spoke Arabic, the women said, "Please take these children with you. We have nothing here. We have no life. Take them with you to America." You know, so it was like, oh my God, you know. So we kept on walking. We didn't know. We didn't have a guide with us or anything. We didn't know where to go. Where's the bus going to meet us, right? We're just literally wandering around as a group, though. And then some young commandos, actually this was one of the scariest things, because some young commandos kind of followed us, and they ushered us into this old factory, and they sat us down, they pointed guns at us, and, you know, it was just like, you know how, like, young men who don't have work and their power and guns, and, you know, like, this to them would be like, you know, yeah. No, like, okay, we got them there. So it was kind of like this, they were really young guys, they were like in their teens. It was really scary. It's like, God, you know, at least before we were working, this was adults, you know, they had a movement. These guys are just like the wild, wild west. So very scary again. And then finally we kept walking, and we did find the bus. And we got on this small bus, and they took us, they took us from this refugee camp to Amman, and we were on a real road, you know, like a paved road. And I was so scared. I was so scared that there were landmines and bus. Bus was going to blow up. Something was going to happen. Another thing was going to happen. So then we get to Amman. They bring us to a hospital in Amman. So we didn't know if we were supposed to be patients or what, you know, like, just someplace to be there, because kind of a hospital is sort of a neutral place. So the nurses, though, turns out we did stay there for the night in some, you know, cots, and they gave us some food, and we still didn't shower or anything like that. So we hadn't showered for a month. then the nurses, though, they wanted to show us what this war between the PFLP and the government, what it had done to the people of Jordan and to the Palestinians in Jordan. So they sort of took us around, showing us the children who were maimed, you know, these people lying in the halls and gurneys, you know, for someone like a child without a leg. I mean, these horrible things, right? Kind of trying to say, you know, this is your government. This is the kind of work that, you know, you do, Israel does. So it was just, that was just another. So then the next day, they put us on a plane. We sleep there the night. In the morning, we leave from Amman, the 30 of us. Actually, it was a helicopter. Big helicopter. We all get in the helicopter. We go to Nicosia.
Where is this?
Cyprus.
Okay.
Neutral country.
Mm-hmm.
We land in Cyprus. We get off this small helicopter. Big helicopter. And they, you know, kind of like one of these army planes. And they say, well, suddenly, they say, you can go into this room if you want to. The press are there. Or you can go into, you know, this room, which is empty, you know, just so you can be there quietly. So, you know, I thought, okay, well, I'll go into the press room, see what it is. So they open the door, and there's, like, lights, and there's, like, a million journalists with their cameras and the flashes. And they're like, what happened? And, you know, and I was about to speak, and I realized I can't say anything. And I turned around and walked away. I think some people talked then. Then they put us in a hotel, in the Hilton, in Nicosia, Cyprus, and they told us, you know, to go downstairs and buy clothes. Eat. So we did that. I don't know why this part is sad. Call your parents. I did that. They're very happy. The next day, we flew. They took us on a plane, only the 30 of us, to Rome. And in Rome, President Nixon was the president at the time. Mm-hmm. He was on a European tour, and he was in Rome. And he came on the plane to meet us. But I was so against this horrible man that I wouldn't come out. And in fact, when we were, you know, we had this practice in those days of like the yippie movement, you know, of yippieing. Yip, 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 yip. And so I was on the plane and I was doing that. I was actually outside the door waiting on like the steps. People were on the steps waiting for the president to come on the plane to meet us. And I was like, I cannot believe you guys. We've just been hostages for 30 days. No one did anything for us. You know, like this guy is, you know, he wasn't yet impeached. But it was like, why are we now so enamored with the president when our country did nothing for us? So, you know, and he's doing this for good press. Does nobody else see this, you know? So they said, well, if you don't have a good attitude towards the president, please go inside and sit down. So I went inside, and, you know, people greeted shook hands for a photo shoot, a photo op. And then after, you know, an hour, we continued on our way to New York. And then I got home, and I was a wreck.
Wow.
It was a total wreck. And I was a wreck for I was so paranoid and afraid. I was laying in my bed, in my home, you know, my childhood bed. I was just so, like, and my parents couldn't relate at all. Like, they never really talked about emotions and feelings anyway.
Ma'am?
Yeah?
One detail you left out was
what?
When they, if I remember correctly,
yes,
was them saying that every free and we know where you live.
Oh, yes, they did say that. Yes, that's right.
So you couldn't, like, even talk about it with your parents because they didn't understand?
Not really. And I think that really clamped me up, probably for good. No, they couldn't. No. You know, like, some other guy that I know who's also one of the hostages, he was my age. His name was David. And he had a really opposite experience. He was religious, a religious Jew. I wasn't, you know, religious at that time at all. And he was kind of brought in. He was a college student in a religious university in New York. And they wanted to hear all about it. And he was forced to, like, well, not forced, I think, but wanted to talk about it. They had a lot of questions, and they asked him all about it. And as a result, I think different people respond differently to things. Like, some people, he told me that one of the women never told her family. I mean, not her parents, of course, knew, but, you know, she got married, and her husband never knew. Her children don't know. And so different people, like, some people, sort of took to their bed afterwards and could, you know, like, older people were just, like, done with it. That was it. You know, within a few months, like, one person died, right? And people got divorced. I mean, people, like, just, like, people come back from war, right? Yeah. Because you're exposed to so much in such an intense, you know, time. But, so I was home for a few weeks. And then I wanted to go back to college because I couldn't live at my, you know, parents' house, really. It didn't help me to be there. I didn't want to, you know, what to do. So I went back to college. And the first day when I came back, I was standing in front of this student union. You know what that is? It's like, you know, a place where people hang out. And it was sort of the end of the day, I think. And people that I had seen who I knew before were like, oh yeah, we heard about that hijacking thing far out. That must have been really cool. You were like really with like gorillas. Because there was such a romanticized idea of, you know, being a gorilla and this, you know, sort of counter agency and terrorism, because that was, you know, we were dealing with Vietnam at the time, so being something counter to that was very cool, like going against this imperialist government that was, you know, trying to take over, you know, we were against that, right? But yet nobody had ever experienced the fear and the real experience of people blowing up, people dying, you know, all that, like soldiers experience every day. So I realized the naivety of my friends. Or, you know, not necessarily my close friends, but the people in my bigger network. But people really did say that. All right, man, that must have been really amazing stuff. Shit, man. You know, like, it was like, then I met Mark, and we had gone out beforehand, having met when he was playing the guitar. And then he took me to his apartment and really took care of me. And I don't know what it was like then. I was a mess. But you took care of me. I didn't do any. I didn't have to deal with the world. I guess I went to class sometimes. I don't know. Yes, I did. But you brought food and everything like that. Cooked. Did the essentials of life.